Hello and welcome to This Way Up. I'm Babette Gallard.
And I'm Terry Shakanovsky. Babette, this is one of the instances where I wish we were on camera because then everybody could see those beautiful beads around your neck. I have been a fan of Joni Brenner's beads for years now, excited as a new consignment arrives from Zimbabwe and then Joni displays them to gorgeous effect. If you've seen Joni Brenner's marigold beads, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And if you haven't, you'll want to. And I promise you, like Babette, you'll be sold.
And I am completely sold. First of all, of course, by the beauty of the beads, but also by the idea that Joni has worked with these beaders from Zimbabwe, first of all, to enable them to support their families, but also to combine her own talents as a painter, sculptor, and Wits academic with theirs to produce necklaces that are truly, truly unique.
And she's done it in such extraordinary ways, including collaboration with world-renowned artist William Kentridge and scientists from Wits University. Here's Joni to tell the whole wonderful story.
So the story of the beads, when I think about how it started, the word in my mind is accidental, so unplanned. And it took even a few months to realize that actually this was something that could really grow. My mother was in Bulawayo. So I was born there and my family's had a presence and a life and business and dealings in Bulawayo for a long time up until quite recently. And she'd been there and she had phoned me up to say there was this beadworking cooperative. They didn't have a lot of work and the work they did was beautiful. And when I asked her to describe it or to tell me how it was beautiful, she just said to me, it's made on a loom. And of course, loomed beadwork is not something that you find in South Africa, even though, as we all know, South Africa has got this huge and incredible and impressive tradition of bead making. But a lot of the beadwork is either stitched or picked or built onto another surface, and it's not made on a loom. So I also didn't really know how to visualize it. And I said, well, it would be great to see a sample, just out of ordinary curiosity. And this strip of beadwork arrived a couple of weeks later, and I looked at it and I thought, it really is beautiful. And I was playing with it. It immediately invites you to play with it. It has a tactility and the beads have got a mobility, and you can see the stitching really clearly, and the structure of the grid is also apparent in the warp and weft threads. I remember turning around, I don't know who was in the room, and I said, I don't know, is this a nice necklace? And I said, great, I'd love three. And maybe they could be at slightly different lengths so that when you wear them together, they don't all sit at the same point. And when I think about it now, that was the conceptualization of the design. And that's pretty much what we've stayed with. So a couple of weeks later, these three necklaces arrived. And I remember they were in purple grape kind of color and a gold, pure solid band, so not yet mixed. I mean, I'm sure my mother paid for them. I don't even know what she paid, where those beads came from. And at that point, I wore them to the Johannesburg Art Fair where I had a stand. And by the end of the fair, I must have had about 30 or 40 different interactions with people who were saying, where did you get these? What are they? Who made them? Where can I get them? I've never seen anything like this. This is beautiful. Can I try it on? Like these invested engagements over these three necklaces that felt like they just landed on my neck. And anyway, the fair ended and I had some follow-up calls. You know, when you have that feeling and you think you should pay attention to this. All of this at this point was like via my mother. You know, it took a while for me to say, can I have the number of the beader who's in charge? I want to discuss a few things with her. But at the beginning, they'd sent, I don't know, maybe there were like 30 necklaces in about six different colors. And I invited a few people over around the table to have a look. And on that evening, there were only about four or five people who came. And at the end of the evening, there were no necklaces left. People just walked out with them. I think I wasn't even sure exactly how to price them. I had a lot to learn still, let's put it that way. But at this point, anyway, all the beads left that night. And then I asked for a few more. And literally almost, if you fast forward 13 years to where we are today, that is how the project has grown.
So what has your project meant for the loomers and beaders back in Bulawayo?
In fact, and I'm always at pains to say this, that it's not a cooperative that I started, you know, this is a pre-existing cooperative. They started, I think, in the early 1990s. So, you know, they've been going already a long time, and there was a market, and they were making some traditional things like headbands and wristbands and anklets and aprons and things like that, but also some sort of beaded garments for rock stars and for beauty pageants and Miss Bulawayo, and her dress was beaded. And it's just amazing how it really felt like this thriving group. And they always tell me, the beaders, when we've spoken about it over the years, they always say to me, we were trained in how to run a cooperative and how to do our own marketing, but the technique is ours. I think it's a really important distinction, this technique of working on the loom. And when I did some research on different bead techniques, you see it all the way down the east coast of Africa, and you see it in Malawi, almost like it came all the way down, but it stopped at South Africa. One of the beaders in the group, whose parents are Malawian, and when she joined the cooperative, she said, you know, this is so familiar. And she showed me some pictures of beadwork that her mother had made. And so you see how these techniques travel through individuals and by exposure, I suppose, or influence, being part of a community. The 16 women that are in the cooperative today are almost the same 16 women that have been in the cooperative when we started working together in 2011.
So who are these women? And how did they end up coming together to form this cooperative?
When I met them, there were only three, and the others were brought in when there might have been work. And things were really hard, and then people didn't have money. You know, there wasn't even really a currency. People who did have money weren't buying accessories and jewelry. They were surviving. And you see it today, you feel it when you visit there. It's really survival mode.
It sounds like the beating might have stopped if you hadn't stepped in. Is that right?
It could have, and it could have taken on a different form. Like, I know they did work with another woman at some point who wanted them to bead handbags. So, and that's so far away from this loomed technique that feels so kind of authentic to the region. It's part of what's been, for me and for the beaders equally, maybe more, so extraordinary, is how technically I'm a client. What I do is I buy everything that they make in a month. It allows a kind of security, I think. The beaders know this is what is being spent every month, and I will buy whatever they make, and they then can plan what is coming in every month and how they can manage their own costs and living.
It's amazing security for them, but it's also a big commitment for you, isn't it?
In addition to that, I'm also sending everything that they need. So all the raw materials, the beads, the threads, the tape measures, I pay for the studio, so the rent, and, you know, all of that. So this is also why it's difficult for them to get another client, because say they got another client who wanted them to make something else, then, you know, the beads belong to me, the space belongs to me. It's like,
I think this is called a monopoly.
In a weird way. So it's a complicated structure or situation. And it is, in a way, it's true what you point out, Babette. It's true that, you know, I carry the risk. But, I mean, you've been at the pop-up shops and you see the risk is not so big because the beads move.
And so you buy every month what they make, and then what happens?
They get trucked up from Bulawayo, and they're all muddled up and mushed together, and I lay them all out and I double check everything.
Ooing and aahing.
Ooing and aahing all the time. Never has there been a boring month in all these years. They do quality control, then I do quality controls. And that's when I can really see that in a month of production, there is a very acute attention to the building of ranges. And there are definite groups that appear in a month's production, and they can imagine in a way what a buyer or a wearer is looking for. This that might go with that, this that might disrupt that. A lot of what I do is position the beads, so I can help people see them in ways that are actually digestible. I think it's one of my contributions as a sort of honorary member, client member of the cooperative. I can, and I have, made people aware of exactly what they're buying and what they're looking at and how there are multiple voices and decisions and choices that happen at the making level, that happen at the combining and wearing level. And I've also learned ways over the years of how best to display them and how to make it into a positive and really creative experience for a wearer. When people come to buy beads here, they know that they also have to do their part of thinking, right? They've got to look and think and combine and put together. It's not just a thing, here it is. It's like, here's toys. How are you going to play? And then, because he's also the person, right? It's like, this color works with that color and look great on you. And on you, it needs to have another thing added or something subtracted or a different thing altogether. I always think this about my own work as an artist, but I think it's exactly the same with the beaders. The viewer or the audience completes the work. People do their own things with them, and I'm always surprised by that.
Joni, there's no funding for it all. Is it entirely self-sustaining?
It's self-sustaining, so there's no funding. And you know, Terry, when I say it like that, part of me thinks we should get a grant, we should get funding. But there's another part of me that says, this is not an NGO, this is not a charity. This is a group of artists making wantable objects. And it's so fantastic that it's wantable enough that we can make some more. People have often asked me, you know, why does this work and that startup or that idea didn't take off? And, you know, it is hard. And I think we have been lucky. Maybe it just appeared at a time where it was novel and these are easy to wear because they don't have clasps and they don't have buckles or anything that can go wrong. It's just a pure loop. But more than that, I think that when you have a funder, then you also have to listen to that funder a little bit or a lot, depending. And that's where it could potentially really go wrong.
Clearly, this is all about relationships, yours with the beaders and then with the people who see the beads and want to wear them. Can you talk a bit more about that?
The way I work as an artist and the way they work as artists has got a lot in common, a shared language. What happens in the creative zone of a studio is something I think funders don't really know about. So if you say, we want 200 red necklaces, you're going to get 200 red necklaces. That is going to be the end of your story. And you're going to have a team of people who feel like machines. And with the beaders, it's taken a long time for all of us to know that we meet on the same page. I think there were some very hard experiences that the beaders had before I met them. But we're now in such a groove. We all know we have to just try things. Some of them are going to work. Some of them are not going to work. The understanding is it's a starting point. We're going to try this design. We're going to try it in the beaders' language, in 8 beads, in 16 beads, in 24 beads. These are the widths of the necklaces. I call them classic, broadband, super, or whatever. But with the beaders, it's like 5 beads, 8 beads, 16 beads, sometimes 12 beads, extra long, skinny, you know. We have our own language, and we know that when a design starts, it needs to be played with. So it's very organic. So sometimes I'll get 8 giant necklaces that are not big sellers because they're very expensive, or I might get a lot of skinnies, and it's very playful. They need to just arrange it so that the numbers add up and they can invoice me for products that add up to what we agreed on. So within that, there's so much freedom, and they need to take control of that, and they know it.
And how do you actually turn all of this into a business?
I always think I'm glad I've got another job and, and other sources of income, because it's not anything that I really have got a tight control over. So some months are really fantastic. And I've had to learn to know that even when it feels like a little bit close to the edge, these things do happen, and they've continued to happen, and they will happen again. That's where I have to really kind of grow up and learn to trust. I struggle with that. You can like creep sometimes quite close to a point where you think, I can't do this. And then something happens and you think, oh my gosh, we must make more, lots more. You know, it's not just this amazing money-making situation, but actually I feel also at the same time profoundly supported by every single person who buys a bead. And it does kind of tick over. Sometimes there's enough that I can put a bit of a cushion in place for pandemics and other things. You can't just rest, actually. You can't just say, oh, this is doing its own thing. And that there is something where, because there isn't that same pressure on the beaders who have to arrive every day, and it's hard work, and it's not for everyone. Because there isn't that financial uncertainty, it allows a relaxation and a pleasure and a joy in the studio, which is, for me, completely crucial.
You're listening to Joni Brenner on This Way Up.
After the break, Joni talks about running a William Kentridge workshop in rural Zimbabwe, the challenges of making art commercially viable, and how she lives with the responsibility of supporting so many livelihoods.
I do a lot to facilitate the ongoing. It's between a studio in remote Bulawayo and then here in Johannesburg, and how I can reach out and work with a whole lot of other artists and scientists and researchers. I'm thinking about the Oceanic Project that we did with the scholars at WISER at Wits University, who did this Oceanic Humanities for the Global South large research project. Part of the grant was to be put in some way towards the creative expression of the research. And at that point, researchers in that team said, what would an oceanic marigold look like? And it was so beautiful and it made so much conceptual sense. We published a paper on it. And
how did you actually bring these ideas to life with the beaders?
So with the special projects, with every special project, I have always flown to Bulawayo and spent a few days, and we have had intensive workshops with the beaders. You know, so there's different participation and thought process and attention to how you realize a design that comes either from the researchers, from me or the beaders, and it has to cohere. And that can only happen in person. You know, with William and the work that we did, this group of beaders in remote Bulawayo are so well versed in the work of William Kentridge. They watched all the films, they've seen all the books. And some things like the opera and the production for Waiting for the Sibyl had such a profound resonance with the beaders, because that story is this woman living in a Greek cave who is a soothsayer who's telling people's fortunes and making predictions. And the story is that people come to her with their questions, and then she'd write the answers and leave them on an oak leaf outside her cave. Problem was, when the wind came, you know, blew the leaves all over the place, and then everybody got the wrong fortune. And when we discussed this, and when we watched the rehearsal for it and William speaking about it and the performers reflecting on it, and we looked at all the prophecies that are so, you know, painful but also outrageous and amazing and provocative, the beaders just related. And you can understand this relationship with Sangomas and Inyangas and all of these complexities of being a human being. I mean, you could just feel that this was well and truly understood.
For listeners who haven't seen this series of designs, can you describe them for us?
So the first iteration of that design, we used that royal blue bead because the way William had produced the book Waiting for the Sibyl, he used a lot of prints in cyanotype, which is blue. So I thought we'd use that blue to make a link. And the beaders knew that and they'd seen the book. And then the text and the prophecies were, you know, included in the design, and the beaders beaded that. But when they'd done the first iteration of it, I looked at it and I said, it needs a bit of life. And I said to them, I'd like to introduce some shapes, and I think that those shapes should be in the color of the autumn leaves. And I didn't have to say more than that. And then these necklaces arrived with shapes that were in the most exquisite coppers and golds, russet and coral. And there was never a color that you would say, oh, that's not autumn.
Well, we'll ask you shortly for website and details where listeners can find the extraordinary things you've been talking about. Firstly, how can people get behind you? How can they support you? And secondly, any tips for anyone who's mad enough to do what you've done?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I think the best way for people to support us is to buy the beads. And it's easy to do. So we don't have online sales, but I've got a website, www.marigoldbeads.com. And I mean, just before you came, I was busy responding to someone who'd said, please, can I look at what you've got in these kind of colors? And I've just put out like 10 necklaces, and this person said, this. And can you Uber it? then, you know, if people aren't in Joburg and can't be Ubered to, we use Postnet, we use DHL, we ship all over the world. So the beads are available through me mostly, but people can come and we just make a time and they can either browse and look here or do it online or wait for a pop-up shop. And they are at SAD Studios in Cape Town, which is affiliated with Smack Gallery. They carry a constant small selection, but beautiful. And that's where the beads are, me and them, and from time to time, a couple of other places. And then tips, oh my gosh. I do think that starting off with a plan in which you think you know where you're going is a kiss of death.
Well, that sentence didn't end the way I thought it would.
If you know where you're going, you're dead in the water. But it also takes courage, I think, to go with something. And this, I think, is I could be speaking about anything. Go and follow a path where you have no idea where it's going. I mean, it is scary and difficult, but also you find things that you couldn't have imagined. And then you don't have to be the control freak, which I am. And this is why it's hard. The letting go, the following, the noticing and following, I think is really where it is. And to not fall into the production line trap, I think it closes down the space for creativity as opposed to opening up an opportunity.
Okay, so no big planning. Got it. But do you have any thoughts or hopes for the future?
So what I've learned is that there's something to be said for continuity. So when I've said you don't want to get into a production line, and then you could easily say to me, yeah, but you've made one necklace for 13 years. So I think repetition is different to replication. Mm-hmm. We're not making the same thing over and over again, even though we're working within these limits and constraints of the necklace that looks like this, that uses these materials. But we are always looking for what has been done and what small change can happen to take it one step further, because craftwork depends on deep knowledge with the material. And it helps you continue to be an innovator. And I think that that is something that is really important. And when I say be an innovator, I don't mean find brand new things all the time. Think about where it can still go. When I look at the drawers and the beads, and you will have seen it and felt it at the pop-up shop, what you're actually looking at is a whole lot of thinking and a whole lot of feeling, process and voices and decisions and choices and omissions and continuity. So that's where the life is. It's not someone signing off on something that's decided. And I think that's what I meant by, you know, the kiss of death if you think you know where you're going. One of the real gifts in this project is that it has got its own inbuilt continuity. And I think that is a real secret for starting something that you want to see into the future.
The beads I'm wearing now feel completely different. Does that sound crazy?
No, totally. What lies behind each strand?
I suppose one of the things that sits with me and will for a long time is the thought of those beaders from Bulawayo, who really have very little contact with people outside their homes, working with artists like William Kendridge and actually sharing some of the stories, like the Sybil, that links into their own culture. I wonder what that feels like for them.
I think that's the magic of Joni. She has such a humanity to the way she works, to the way she respects the creativity and artistry of the women she works with.
And she's taken such a risk doing that. If you think about it, she pays for the studio, she buys whatever work they produce, and then she takes it from there.
And takes out a bond on her own flat to do so. Utterly amazing.
I don't think there's many people who would do that. Terry, I think I'm carrying a story around my neck.
Oh, Babette, I love that. I absolutely love that. And I hope I carry many stories in my drawer. But I hope that the people listening will be inspired to go and buy their own strand of beads. They're beautiful. You won't be sorry.
Thanks again to Joni Brenner.
And if you want to support Joni in other ways too, please rate or review this episode wherever you get your podcasts. It helps people to find her and the others we talk to. Thank you for listening to This Way Up.